ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is James Stone, independent design systems engineering consultant, and surprisingly, we're going to talk about design systems. This episode is brought to you by Zencastr. It's the easiest way to record your podcasts in studio quality, free from any Skype glitches or artifacts, like we do here at UI Breakfast. Simply send a link to your guests, and they will be recorded in separate tracks straight from their browser. To check it out, go to zencastr.com and use your promo code UI Breakfast to get 20% off your first 3 months. Hi, James.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on the show.
We are thrilled to have you. How about we start with a quick blitz questionnaire and then jump to the main body of the conversation?
Sounds great.
Fantastic. Question number one, as always, is what do you do for a living?
Sure. I'm an independent design systems engineering consultant. And, you know, typically what I do is I work on redesigns, or sometimes it's called UX heavy changes, across teams that don't really have the specialized knowledge either to quickly translate visual designs into performant front-end code, and also the documentation that goes along with that that can be used by an engineering team for building out production, you know, marketing sites and web apps. I also have a little bit of a split life. I'm also an assistant teaching professor at Penn State, and I teach an online course that is within the School of Visual Art, which is basically scripting for artists and designers, and so teaching artists and designers how to code.
Oh, wonderful. That is so necessary for all of us. Next question. How did you get there? Your background story.
Yeah. I would say the short story is you know, many years ago, like maybe 5-6 years ago, I started working on these fast-paced redesigns with agencies and smaller enterprises. And kind of before, I would say, design systems became very popular, I started to see the inefficiencies, the communications, and all this kind of things go astray in a project. And also the kind of gap in knowledge, which was the translation and also maybe communicating to engineering departments. The long story is I have probably a very esoteric background, which starts with me dropping out of high school. So,
okay. Yeah. And, yeah. And you end up as a professor. Wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I will try and be brief, but basically, you know, I was always into computers as a kid. They were kind of like the hot new technology and no one knew much about them. My mom taught me actually how to program when I was in second grade on an old Atari. And I don't know why she did this. I still ask her for reasoning why. And she said they were starting to use computers, meaning like mainframe computers, in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. And she thought it was a good idea. She didn't know it would lead to a career. And so in high school, I was super obsessed with computers and programming. I was kind of hacking computers. I got into a lot of trouble. And they said, look, you know, this is not, you're not going to stay here. And so I went to college for a while, and I ended up discontinuing my education, never graduated. Longer on, you know, later on, I kind of went back to school, and I actually ended up studying art. So I had a career as a software engineer, self-taught and taught on the job. And then I kind of switched, you know, full direction to working in graphic design and art, and maybe overcompensated a bit, but went all the way through to get an MFA in new media and art. And so right now I'm very interested in kind of this intersection between art and design and engineering.
Great. What does your typical day look like?
Yeah. So, you know, I work for myself. So, you know, I would say I wake up, I try to spend time with my family, with my wife in the morning, and try and have a calm morning. And then if I can, I try to spend at least 30 minutes doing focused writing. And so I try to be quiet. I listen to the same music every day and usually work on like an iPad Pro. And so I try to focus and do my writing early in the morning when I have a lot of focus. And then after that, it's kind of a mix of client work, business development, and also interacting with my students at Penn State. Because as you might imagine, as they're going through their day and working through the course online, they certainly have questions here and there about code, or, you know, things in the course. And so that's typically what my day looks like.
What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
Yeah, I would say the thing that I enjoy the most is kind of like being in this space where I get to work with designers, you know, really high quality design. I have an affinity for art and design, and so I love doing that. I have a background myself. And then also, I really like seeing that come to life, like seeing it become like a tangible product. So kind of going from, you know, the design files to being an actual thing that you can interact with and people are using on devices, and seeing that kind of all the way through. And so I really enjoy that process. I feel like it's really tangible. I started out doing back-end development, which is nothing wrong with that. But I always felt like it was hard to explain what I did for a living. Like, even if you can imagine in the 1990s, to try and explain to someone what a database was. And then I felt like it was hard for me to explain. And it was just maybe, I think I get a lot of energy after, you know, seeing things interact and move around and the visual nature of projects.
This is almost like magic for me. Do you work specific? So do you do development yourself, or do you just work as a bridging person between designers and engineering teams?
Yeah, so I would say my background is in doing front-end development. And so I also have design background. Mm-hmm. But I basically became very highly skilled in this area of like the translation. So to differentiate, you know, some front-end developers focus maybe on Angular, some particular technical bit. Like I really like working with CSS, SAS, organization on big projects. So I just really focus there. And so that's kind of how I got into what I'm doing. Nowadays, I'm doing a lot less hands-on coding myself. I'm doing more training and kind of advising and maybe architecting of projects.
Uh-huh. That's what I was looking for. What do you like the least about your work?
Yeah. So I would say probably the thing I would say it's something that I actually like the most and the least about my job, but I would say being my own boss. And often if I talk to like friends from high school, for example, and they ask what I'm doing and you say something and they go, oh, you work for yourself. Oh, that must be so much fun to have all the freedom and all that time and flexibility. And it is fantastic sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I would say the dark side of that equation is I probably have like the most tenacious, overworking boss too. So it's hard to find balance. And I think where it really manifests for me is when I'm like critically sick or overloaded in my life. And I've never had a job when I worked at corporate where I took a couple of days off because I was sick or for other reasons, and then came back and thought, how can I make up these several days that are gone like in the same amount of time or by working all the time? And so it's difficult to kind of let those things go and to kind of have a realistic expectation for work. Because I never had a boss that said, great that you're back. I want you to work for 36 hours straight. But for some reason in my head, it sometimes becomes that, yeah.
Yeah, and there's this temptation, your workplace is always there, and you're like, but you have a whole night ahead, let's go, let's kick an all-nighter.
Yeah, exactly.
Really bad. Really bad, we should all avoid it.
Yeah, I agree.
What is your next big thing?
Yeah, so the next big thing I'm working on right now, I'm calling it the Design Systems Accelerator. And what this is it's for lead designers who want to gain confidence in things such as front-end code, SAS and CSS, the organization behind that, maybe using a systems-based approach to design, and how to create developer documentation that engineering teams are going to love. So not one you're going to kick over the fence and they're going to resist using, but ones that they're going to really enjoy using in the project and kind of adopt into their process.
That sounds wonderful. Is there a link that I can include in the show notes?
You know, I don't have a link yet, but probably by the time the show goes live, there'll be something live on the site talking about it.
Okay, so people can just head over to your website and find it there.
Yes, exactly.
Fantastic. So let's go and discuss design systems. From what you told about what you're doing, this is just exactly what's missing from a ton of workflows, especially for us independent consultants. Unless we're an agency, we're totally disconnected, and you're just bridging that gap between design and development. Tell us about design systems. How would you define them?
Yeah, the way I like to think about design systems, and you'll hear me use the term design systems engineering, is kind of deviating from this idea of just brand guidelines, which I think is really a carryover from print, and going beyond that. And because my experience kind of comes from in the trenches, building out projects, you know, and creating front end code that's going to be used by, say, a back end team, I have a lot of empathy, not just for the users of the app and their experience using it, but I also have a lot of empathy for the developers who are going to be building it out, and also for the designers who might get frustration in seeing their designs maybe not come to life in a way that is fitting with their vision.
Oh, yes.
And so I would say for me, like, creating a design system is one, it's like a point of friction, right? There's a breakdown in your process where it's no longer efficient. So if you're like a boutique agency and you're doing a lot of the same types of work, it may not necessarily be the right type of solution for you. But I think when you start to work on a major redesign, if you start to work on major changes, if you start to work across multiple web properties, if you start to work across multiple development teams and there's a consistency of brand, I think this is where those systems really can bring a lot to the conversation. They can really kind of make your workflow more efficient and create kind of a center for discussion around the project as you're working on it, you know, in those big changes, but also kind of for the day-to-day maintenance that happens afterwards. And so when I think of design systems, I think of one, a kind of set of methodologies for design in thinking about how things are constructed, right? And so I think this is like the architect understanding what a building is, right? Not just kind of making something up, but understanding what the built environment is. And so I think designers understanding what's the goal and the process. So to be thinking in terms of, like, you know, spacing and units and color and variables and like how to kind of codify that and have it be very consistent across the design assets that are created. And also I think it's a matter of creating developer documentation and a set of front-end code, ideally in isolation, that can kind of act as a blueprint for creating your project or for the ongoing maintenance of it. And I've been on many projects where things fall apart because they're like missing the blueprints, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. A blueprint is a, you know, high level world. How does it translate to actual things? What is it? Is it a document, a library, a sketch file, anything along those lines?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the team, but, you know, in my process and a lot of what I do is kind of going from design to engineering. And there certainly is this feedback cycle back, right? And in dealing with the design team and sharing assets and that type of thing. But this kind of forward momentum maybe is the place to focus. But I would say, you know, in my experience, there's a couple of deliverables that I think really help in terms of like what to include in the design system. And like the design systems may be just like a package, right? Like a briefcase full of things or like a toolkit. But one of them, I think, is having a set of templates or layouts that are in front-end code, so that at least for the major designs, so that engineers are not sitting, you know, in their engineering space going, like, what are these patterns? Like, I don't know how to put all this stuff together. And I think that's what happens if you just have, like, a style guide and the patterns all in isolation, but no guide as to how they come together, you know, as a unit. The other thing is, I think, a coded or living style guide, which is a living document that is similar to front-end code. And it shares, you know, ideally the same SAS and CSS workflow and same files as the production system. And what this allows you to do is to show the components that you've written UI components and show them in the native format. And so you can look at them. You can look at them in isolation. And also it gives a nice thing if you have a coded example pair where you can see the code and kind of copy and paste. And so some of this, I'm not coming up from my own. I've actually been involved with a framework called the Zurb Foundation framework for many years. And so part of my experience also stems from that architecture and working with that product, which is a very large design system.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a brief overview? So there is, please correct me if I'm wrong, because I am no expert in this area. So sure. There is Zurb, there is Bootstrap, and so on and so forth, and a few others. Just what kind of frameworks are they? Can they be used in creating design systems?
Yeah, so I'm a big advocate of using a framework, and certainly there'll be people who disagree with me. But I think for when you're working in a team environment, a framework, pardon the term, but will bootstrap your way into having a better way to work with the team. So a consistency of syntax, terms, architecture. You get all of this from a framework where you don't have to kind of build it all from scratch. And there's other benefits as well, such as cross-browser testing, the fact that it's been around for a long time. So you don't have to spend so much time doing this yourself. So if you write all of your CSS from scratch, well, then when you start to test in different browsers, what you may have thought about it, and depending on your level of familiarity, could be right or wrong. And so it adds a lot of time when you have to go back and kind of start testing things and making sure that they're robust enough. But the frameworks that you mentioned, they're all, I would call them CSS frameworks. There's mm-hmm. JavaScript involved as well, and they've really expanded. But with any of them, the idea is that you could take part of them, you know, piecemeal. So like, let's say you need a grid system and some buttons and a few other things. You can kind of pull those parts out and then kind of build on top of them. And I think Bootstrap is a lot more opinionated and kind of designed out of the gate, is such as UIKit as well. And Zurb Foundation is interesting because it stems out of an agency where they were creating visual design for a variety of clients across a variety of different industries. And so you have all these different visual designs. So it's kind of more bare bones, the visual nature of it. And it's designed so that you would kind of build your design on top of that.
So Bootstrap is aimed at developers who are not proficient in design, and Zurb is a blank canvas for designers.
I would say about Zurb.
Roughly.
Yeah, Zurb is absolutely correct. And I think Bootstrap, some people are using it for design, but it's more kind of designed to be themed, like where you could buy a theme or create a theme that could be used in its entirety by an organization, where Zurb Foundation is really for, you know, you have an agency design and you're trying to go from, you know, a nice visual brand and a specific look into the website, but you don't want to build everything from scratch, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit more about Zurb. I think I know some facts, but I'm afraid I might be wrong. A little bit of the background, who created it?
Okay. Yeah. So Zurb is a design agency. I actually have no affiliation with them whatsoever. So sometimes people get confused because I'm...
Oh, I thought you were working for them.
Yeah.
Here you go. There is confusion.
Yeah. So I don't work for Zurb, but I've been involved with the open source framework for quite some time. And I'm probably well known because I have a YouTube channel where I did a lot of teaching and this kind of thing, where it's been viewed quite a few times. And so Zurb is an agency that's been around since the 1990s, and they do product design for the web. And what they did was they found that they were kind of repeating the same patterns in their design work consistently, right? And so they didn't want to, like I'm saying, you know, rebuild, you know, reinvent the wheel to do these things over and over again. And so they built their own internal framework that they were using for their own projects. And then what happened is they open sourced it, right? And this is quite a few years ago. And so they kind of opened up their process to the rest of the world. And they actually continue to do this today. And I think they actually have a very good process, especially, again, like if visual branding and the visual look and feel of the site are important, I think it's a very good process to follow. I think with other frameworks that you might sit on top of, you're going to spend a lot of time undoing things. And also, you don't get this kind of simple kind of, you know, the simple way that you can kind of blueprint and kind of quickly wireframe your projects and code. It's I think it's very easy to do this in Zurb Foundation and then kind of style it in parallel. Yeah. So that's a quick background, but I'm not, I don't work for Zurb, but
yeah,
I've
sorry,
had some
sorry
work
for this spin-off. I'm just curious because the frameworks, they have been kind of a shadow forest for me for a while. Are there any other famous ones that I should include in the list?
I think Bootstrap is probably the most widely adopted. And I think a lot of that is because it's easy to use. It's kind of more designed out of the gate. And so if you're a developer and you have to build an app or do like a hackathon or you're going for your like 1.0 thing, Bootstrap's a very good product for that, because what you can do is, without knowing a lot about CSS or HTML or the front end, is you can kind of quickly look at examples, much like you would in a design system, and kind of like pick and choose and plunk down different components and very quickly start to build the semblance of a website without having to spend a lot of time designing it up front or learning how all those internals work. And so that's kind of the entry point, I think, for a framework like Bootstrap. And then I think what happens, and you know, to be honest, I actually started with Bootstrap myself a long, long time ago when I started looking into this. So a lot of people start with something like Bootstrap and then start looking towards Foundation because there's a little bit more customization. There's a lot more focus on the design. And when you're taking a design that deviates much from the framework itself, I think it's easier to implement on something like Zurb Foundation.
Mm-hmm. The themes and design systems. Themes are design systems sold for wide use. Is that correct statement?
Yeah, I think in most cases, like when I think of a theme, or theming a framework, I think of things like theming WordPress or theming Drupal. I think of an off-the-shelf thing that I can buy. It has a certain look and feel. And I think if you're working quickly, there's really no problem with doing that, because you can get to something that looks a bit more designed with, you know, less upfront cost and time involved.
Mm-hmm.
But the downside is that your competitor or everyone on the internet can use the exact same theme or purchase it. And so there's like a very low level for entry. And I would also say, you know, for more established brands, keeping the brand consistency will be very difficult if you have a theme or you're building upon that, because of this kind of cookie cutter nature. And so I'm sure you've seen like just random WordPress sites, and then you start to recognize the theme and you're like, oh, this is a, you know, so-and-so theme. And I think if you look at Bootstrap, and I think what people joke around about is they say 80% of the web is built in Bootstrap, right? So I don't know that that's an exact scientific amount, but what you'll find is, once you're familiar with the patterns, is that a lot of people are using it. But if you're looking at the web in general, not all of the sites on the internet are well-designed or have a lot of specificity when it comes to brand.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There are a lot of, like, being unique and being cool, like good looking are different things. Well, I'm not even sure if businesses need to look unique these days. It's probably more about a business value statement. Maybe the look and feel is not that important. Okay, I might be hitting your core expertise here. But I totally understand how design systems, they are first tailored to the way a particular designer thinks about UX, and they're also tailored to your brand and what you do. So there is absolutely no replacement by themes.
No, I totally agree with that, like 100%.
Let's say we're a small agency or like a small team, and we would like to introduce design systems engineering into our process. How would we go around that? Who is responsible for it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And when you say agencies, you know, I'll just assume kind of a general agency working across different industries. But I think it depends on a couple of things. A lot of agencies I've seen actually, you know, I think you could probably delineate between two. There's some that produce really just, you know, visual artifacts, you know, Photoshop files, Sketch, and, you know, even if you're sending those over to like Zeppelin.io or that type of thing, you're still really providing just design assets. And then there's also, you know, agencies that will produce everything end to end. So you're going and working with this agency, and at the end you come out with a complete website or app or WordPress theme or whatever that is.
A living thing. Yeah. The full cycle, the living thing. So we'll probably talk about the last, the letter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it really falls into one of two things. I think if you're working and I would call it a boutique agency, meaning you have a certain style and things are looking very consistent for the most part, there is some visual deviation, but essentially the sites are very similar. The types of products that you're creating, the way the mechanisms that they're, you know, how that's working underneath, if they're like mostly marketing sites, I don't know that an entire design system is really going to benefit you there. I think in that case, what's going to really benefit you is doing something that I like to call a starter project. And so similar to how Zurb has created Zurb Foundation, and they have something called the Zurb template, it's kind of like the starting reset point for their project so that they all have the kind of basic configuration and components starting out. And so I think that's where you're going to gain the most momentum, and also having documentation of how that works so that people are not, you know, I think there's an issue often with development projects where they spend all this time to build something, and then you're supposed to maybe search through the JavaScript code to figure out how it works. And so I think the other important part is, even if you create a starter system, everyone has to have something to kind of refer to understand how to use it. But that gives you a common base to start all your projects from. And so it gives you a lot of consistency, especially if you're working across multiple projects at the same time, multiple clients, overlapping deadlines. And so I think that's really where you're going to gain the most. Now, if you had a much larger dev shop and you're building out like entire apps with a lot of different types of functionality, then I think the deliverable can be much different, where you would gain a lot more.
Yeah, I love the piece of advice for starter projects, because that's, you know, that's technology agnostic. That's applicable to designers, to people who do wireframes, for people who do any kind of development. And it's also just a funny observation. It's also worth it to take extra time to make a specific, really, truly identity-free project so that you can freely use it and customize it and don't worry about, you know, names, fonts, or something else from another project coming up unexpectedly, mm-hmm. which I've seen happen a ton in real life.
Yeah, and I think that's like, I think if you're doing that, like if you're taking the old client project and copying and pasting the whole project and changing the names very quickly, I think this is where you're going to benefit from the starter system. If you're explaining like having the wrong client name come up, like that's a disaster. Like you don't want that to happen. But I think you're going to also create a lot of errors and have less consistency, and you're just going to kind of waste a lot of time because you're going to be redoing the same things every project rather than kind of, you know, getting down to like what's the core elements of the project going forward, and then just starting everything the same way consistently.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Absolutely. So for design systems, mostly typically used in larger projects with their unique, unique visual system, unique UX. Let's talk about these kind of use case then.
Sure. So I think with a larger design system, and, you know, obviously I'm looking at a lot of these for a very large organization, they often have already a team maintaining and creating these, and there's a lot of thought that goes into it for brand consistency, the UI components, how they're being used. You know, lightning design is one I really like to look at, and there's just a ton of these. I think for these organizations, they have a lot of, you know, real key people, and they really understand what they're doing. But I think the problem is where people look at these, like let's say you're not quite Salesforce, right? But you're looking at that and saying, this is what we need. The problem is that those design systems are maybe not exactly right for your organization, either the size, the culture, the teams. And so I think every design system really needs to be created, you know, tailor-made to that particular organization. I mean, certainly there's some deliverables or some commonalities you could speak about between them. But you really have to kind of get those stakeholders together and kind of have everyone understand the process and figure out like what's the way to kind of move forward, if that makes sense. So, you know, I think Nathan Curtis has got a lot of great stuff on Medium if you're interested in this kind of thing.
Can you please recall the name one more time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. Nathan Curtis. Mm-hmm. He's got some really great articles on Medium, and it's really worth looking at some of his ideas and thought process behind it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, you really have to solve this problem yourself. Like you can look, I think it's like with design, right? Like you can look for inspiration, right? Like you can go to an art gallery, or you can go, you know, looking through Dribbble or whatever and seek some inspiration. But it's another thing to just like blatantly copy it. It's just going to be a copy and it may not be effective. I mean, that's a good tool to learn if you're learning design, to kind of copy a master painting or something. But this isn't really what you need to do in a design system for an organization of that size. Like you really have to have a good process. You have to understand like what are the bottlenecks in the project and like what's kind of the path forward from that.
Mm-hmm. So does it usually require like a lot of extra budget, or is it just doing the same things in the right way?
Yeah, so I would say my experience has been mostly with some smaller organizations and smaller enterprise. And so typically I'm not working with like, you know, the Salesforce or this type of thing, because again, you know, they have a whole team of people focused in this kind of thought process. In terms of budget, in the way to think about that is usually you're going to have someone, you know, on site as part of the team kind of moving into a new area, right? And that could either be fractional time, it could be moving into a different position where they're going either from design or development kind of into this intermediary process of the translation, and therefore after that into creating a style guide and a you know, proper design system, and then the team might expand. So I think initially it's about, you know, what types of resources do you have? But certainly if you're going to be hiring new people, then you have to get stakeholder buy-in on that. And I think the best way to do that is to focus really on the business problems that exist without creating that kind of system. You know, the bottlenecks, the slowness, how that's going to manifest. It's usually lots of extra meetings, lots of extra explanation, bugs or issues with the design not going through correctly. This kind of inefficiency is like maybe kind of the catalyst for getting some more stakeholder buy-in.
Yeah, that's valid for any kind of design activities, but this in particular, definitely. Can you specify actual steps in creating a system? Like, or is it very, very different from one project to another?
Yeah, again, you know, I don't know that there's like a de facto, like, here is the step-by-step process, you know, for every organization. Like, this is how you go there.
But I think recommended steps.
Yeah.
Recommended steps.
I think, you know, there's two things. One is like, are you doing like a major version change or a redesign? I think often this can be a nice catalyst for that type of change, right? Because you're making some major changes. And so it's going to be a lot more kind of visually obvious, those changes. I think when you're just doing kind of day-to-day maintenance mode, it's a little bit harder to see, at least for stakeholders. Often they like to see, you know, large visual changes. It's hard to explain things like, you know, just imagine these things are happening underneath. So I think the question is like, where are you now, right? And for me, I like to think back, and I've been doing web development for quite some time, but I like to think back to this kind of like old school broken web development process, which was, you know, somebody created something in Photoshop, kind of tossed it over the fence, and the engineers would try and make some sort of sense of it. You know, and I've been in projects like this myself, and then you would kind of implement it, and then it would go back, and then it was all wrong. And so it led to a lot of redoing of work, of things being kind of inconsistent. And so I think the best thing is, like, one, do you have someone on your team that can do this translation well, right? A designer someone in engineering who can take the visual designs and create the front end code, right? The HTML and CSS that's going to look great, that's going to be spot on, be responsive, look great on every type of device, and also have great user experience. It's going to feel great, going to be fast, efficient, not with, you know, gigantic images that are going to take, you know, 10 seconds to download. Like someone has to kind of occupy this space. And whether it comes from one of those two areas or someone who's placed in kind of an independent team, I think you have to have someone like that. So if you do, that's great. Then it's a question of like what types of documents, what types of ways in communicating are you creating? But if you don't, then that's kind of a big gap on your team, right?
And it's a big gap on a lot of teams in the world. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. and this has been my experience, especially in smaller enterprise. They might have actually a fairly large development team or many development teams, but there's this gap in the visual translation. And there often can be the same type of gap, right? When you look at design and designers, whether they're agencies or whether they're independent, they're not able to, you know, formulate those ideas and come up with the high fidelity mocks and then also make this translation. And there are certainly people who do this, like this is what I do, you know, for a living as well. But it's kind of being aware of that gap. So I think if you have that gap, you have kind of really two choices. Like one is to hire someone that can kind of fill that gap, at least while you're doing that redesign, to kind of, you know, get you bootstrapped and kind of sped off to the next level. Or you're going to have to train someone on your team from either side to kind of fill in the gaps. Otherwise, you get this kind of back and forth, you know, working the designer and then and it's kind of like copying and pasting from Stack Overflow and like, you know, it becomes kind of a disaster. And eventually you get like 80, 90% there and maybe people sign off on it. But this is like a very, very inefficient process. This is almost like building the front end code by trial and error. And so I think what you really need is an expert to come in or start training someone who can be the next expert to kind of really understand the design, your company culture, and how to translate that into something that's going to be a great product.
How would you call this person? Is it a design-driven front-end developer?
Yeah, it's a great question. I call this person a design systems engineer. And I think Yeah, and I think it's important, the engineering part. And I think it's often thrown off. Now, when I say design systems engineer, I don't mean this is like hardcore engineering, like very specific to that. But what I mean is that it really is going to take both disciplines to create this deliverable that's, you know, all of the bits and pieces that come together for a large scale project that's going to be maintainable and last long term, but also be fast, be efficient. It's also going to be written in a way that can be easily translated by the developers, and also in a way that it's going to make sense to designers and be really strong on their design intent, right? And thinking about questions and details and coming back to these teams and getting those questions answered up front rather than just building everything out. And then there's things that are kind of looking less polished, you might say. And so this is what I call this person, design system engineer. And this is someone who I am. And I think you really have to have some understanding of engineering in terms of what are they expecting? How do they think about problem solving? And what are they going to do with this front end code, right? Like once you send them some front end code and a style guide, like what are they going to do with that? And I think this is often the gap that's going to lead to a lot of confusion, a lot of emails back and forth, a lot of extra meetings. If you don't think about that process as being somewhat linear.
Yeah, I see a lot of solutions, but I have no clue how companies can find those people and define those processes. That's probably the place where they should ask you for help.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if you're if this is something that you're struggling with and you're finding that you have some sort of gap, whether you're, you know, project manager and you're working on a team and you're kind of identifying this gap in your team and this inefficiency, or if you're say a designer and you want to kind of get more technical and kind of you're interested in this space and kind of moving into it, but you don't know exactly how, right? Probably the answer isn't to go like on Treehouse or Code School and start learning about Ruby. There's actually some very specific knowledge that I think can really help you. Or I've seen also a lot of engineers that have a lot of aptitude and interest in design, and that could work quite well, you know, in either case.
Let's imagine myself, I'm not a coding designer, and I don't think I will ever have time to learn that, at least in the nearest future. So as a consultant, I'm preparing, you know, high fidelity visual assets for handover to the teams that go and take it to development. What is, do you have any tips for me and for people like myself, how to prepare those assets in the best possible way so that they're happy?
Yeah, I think, you know, coming from a design standpoint, it's not about knowing how to code. And certainly if you don't have the time and you have a very specific focus, you know, don't spend your time trying to learn how to program. It's not really going to solve a problem for you. But I think probably the biggest thing that could help in that case, if you're designing for web projects, is to understand a little bit about how they're being built. And so I don't mean the code, but maybe understanding like the box model, understanding kind of a little bit of the technical bits, just to see how things are being architected and built, and also grid systems and how they reflow and displace in a responsive environment. I think these are going to be really key things to understand so that your designs are going to look fluid in any type of environment. So rather than just like designing for the desktop and, you know, kind of, you know, not understanding exactly the grid system or how that's going to reflow on mobile, if you just understand a couple of those key concepts, I think it can kind of inform the design up front rather than resulting in patterns that have to be rebuilt on mobile that are radically different.
Do you have any resources or reading of your own or someone else who that people can go and learn from?
Yeah, so I would say probably the biggest thing I have is, I have two things. I have a course, and then I also have like a small ebook, which is a collection of writings that talks more about design systems. The course is something that focuses on the box model, and I can hear every engineer in the world yelling at me, "The box model, I already know it." But this knowing the box model and the way that it's taught online is something that's very technical, and they cover all these attributes of what it is. But they don't really explain, okay, here's some modern design patterns. How does this exist in the box model? And so this course, what I've created, is really to show you, here are some common patterns that you're going to encounter in your own designs. And this is how the box model works, just the important parts of it. And this is how it's going to manifest. And I think if you're designing in something like Sketch, it actually is very similar the way in some ways that it's working to the box model. But understanding what the box model was, you would have a better idea of how these components are going to be built when you kind of send them over to the end client.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing you mentioned was the first with the course and the second.
Yeah, the second is a small collection of writings that I have about design systems engineering. And I think this is kind of maybe going a little bit further than what you might want to learn. It's not about teaching code, but it's more about process. So if you're interested in what I've been talking about and you're kind of like, I would say the pain point might be for a designer, at least the designers I've talked to, is they send over the designs, they're beautiful, you're really fired up about it. And then like one of a couple of things happen, like, you know, best case, right? It comes together and they send you the site and it looks beautiful. And you add that to your portfolio and that's great. But also sometimes like they never ever get, you know, like you never see it again, or it's implemented, but you're like, what is this? Right. It's radically different than what you'd kind of envisioned. There's some of the ideas of your design there, but it's really, really deviated a lot. And so I think what this can do is kind of help you understand like the process that I go through when translating visual designs. And so I would say for clients or people who are having this struggle of like how to go from your design assets to what's the next step, understanding this process and having some tools to point them to could really help. And so it's just a small collection of writings and an ebook that you can purchase on my site as well.
That's wonderful. What are the links for this?
Yeah. So I actually have a coupon code I set up for your listeners, and you can just go to James Stone. That's with two S's. So JamesStone.com. /UIbreakfast. And so if you go there, I have a small discount code that you can use, and it's also going to link you to the different products that I've talked about in this episode.
Wonderful. I'm totally sold on this, because the way I learned to overcome these things is just not to take them personally, because real life is so interesting.
Yeah.
Really, I am so sold on the way how to fix at least part of it, part of this hard transition. All right. And generally speaking, where can people find you online?
Yeah. So I just gave you the URL for my site if you wanted to check out the products, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But I would say probably the best thing to do if you're interested in what I've been talking about, if you're interested in this process, or just kind of getting to know me a little bit better, the best way to do that actually is not to go directly to my website, but I have another site set up for a list. And you're like, okay, I'm on like 100 lists. I don't want to be on this list, but this is different. And what I have is I have a free email course to teach you more about design systems engineering. And I've got two really quick wins that you can use on your team, and also some ideas about how you can sell this process to management in your organization. And so one thing is you get the course, but then you can get on this list. And if you go to my website, you'll find I actually don't have anywhere where I advertise this list. I talk about the course, but you actually can't get onto my list except through taking the course. And so if you take the course, what happens is I have this kind of special laboratory and kind of my inside circle and group. And what I do is every day, every weekday, I send out an email talking about behind the scenes stuff, new things that I'm experimenting with, new processes, my own experience in my own projects. And basically, if you're interested in this world between, you know, design and engineering, it's going to be something you'll be really excited about. And you're going to get to know who I am very quickly. And if it doesn't work out for you, you can just unsubscribe, no problem. So if you're interested in that, it's designsystemscrashcourse.com. And if you go there, you can sign up for the free course, and then you'll be added to my list once you're done.
Wonderful. So you're one of those crazy productive people who email their list every single day. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I am.
Oh, I have such high respect for you.
Thank you.
All right. James, thank you so much for joining us today. This was very, very insightful to just get an idea how this, this flow, this ecosystem, this hard transition phase works. And I hope our listeners take the time to take the course and to learn more from you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me
today. Have a great day.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.